One, two, three. This is Dr. Alex Avila, and this is Love University, and we're back. I'm an author, psychologist, and speaker. Every week, we talk about how to improve your life, your love, your relationships, and also your self-esteem, and even your performance. And today, I have a very special guest I'm very excited to have, Mr. Greg Steinberg. Dr. Steinberg is a sports psychologist, a speaker on emotional toughness and resilience. He has a doctorate in human performance psychology. He's a best-selling author of Full Throttle and other books. And also, he's rated as one of the top world's best performance psychologists and motivators in the world. He's worked with pro golfers, NFL, NBA, Major League Baseball, the Alabama football team, and also has been an executive coach with top corporations. He's also known as a media host and radio personality and a professor. And he even worked on Dancing with the Stars as a consultant. Hello, Greg. How are you?
Thanks for having me on the show.
And with all those accolades, the only thing I want to know is, why do they call you the Mighty Steiny?
Well, when I was in I played tennis growing up, and my last name's Steinberg.
Yes.
So they used to call me the Mighty Steiny.
I get it. And you worked with Dancing with the Stars as a consultant. Now, you say you don't really dance, and I do a little salsa dance being Latin. But what got you on that show? That's a very interesting venture.
Yeah, well, I was just on there one time for the results section. Yes. They asked me how the Stars can handle the pressure week in and week out of learning a new dance. They're being judged. Of course, it's live.
Yes.
And so the idea was how they could be mentally tough week in and week out.
I see. Now, speaking of mentally tough and overcoming adversity, I know this is a sad thing, but you mentioned that your dad died when you were a young guy and on the tennis team. And you said you went to see a psychologist and you started to beat a pillow with anger. Why were you so angry?
Because he died.
Okay. So you weren't angry.
So, you know, repressed feelings about your dad dying. Yeah.
Yes. So you weren't angry at him per se, but you were just angry at the tragedy of the death that happened.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. And then you're going to repress a lot of your anger, and then that comes out in other ways, like hitting and being mad at other people.
I see. Now, in a lot of your material, you talk about emotional toughness and mastery, and you have a term called full throttle, which means to go with full energy and speed without burning out. Tell us a little bit about the full throttle. Why should we be going so fast? Shouldn't we take it easy in life and just relax, or should we go 100%?
Well, that was the book title, Full Throttle. But the idea is that if you don't master your emotions and you don't live a purposeful life, you typically are going to burn out. And so we called the book Full Throttle because people are going full steam ahead, yet they're burning out. And so you have to figure out how to master your emotions and live a purposeful life so you don't do that.
No, but are you saying we should go full throttle? Should we go with 100% intensity? Or do you think it depends on the situation?
Well, it depends on the situation, but the idea is that people do go full throttle. And of course, we all have heard of the work-life balance situation. Yes. They don't have enough balance in their life.
Right.
And then ultimately, they burn out. Some people can go with greater, let's say, energy every day than other people. And so it's really about mastering your energy, not mastering your time. And so as an example, one of the chapters in the book talks about energy management,
yes,
which is figuring out when your energy peaks and when it, slumps, and then matching the tasks that fit that energy level. So when you have high energy, you should match them with high energy tasks. And when you have low energy, match them with low energy tasks. And therefore, you'll be most productive at those moments.
Yeah, I think you mentioned that as awareness or cycling with energy. And you say that you can also readjust your levels. So let's say you get up at 9 in the morning, but your peak time is at 11. Should we sleep in until 11? Or what should we do to get that extra energy?
Well, just as an example for me, I have great energy in the morning.
Right.
And then by 6 o'clock, I really take a tumble.
Yes.
Well, I teach a graduate class Monday nights. So the way I kind of push my levels to later is that I kind of, we might say, putter around until about noon so that, and I, you know, take it easy so that when the evening comes, I have that energy.
Makes a lot of sense. Now, you do talk about, Greg, the six emotional strengths. And I think you even have an assessment tool, a test people can take. And you talk about, I think, awareness, we just mentioned about your energies, preparedness, and even emotional bravado. The word bravado is, people strike it as reckless or arrogant. Are you talking about that, or is it a different kind of bravado?
Well, I just meant being brave in the face of fear. So it's really dealing with your fears and facing your fears full throttle.
I see what you're saying. So tell us about those six mastery tools. They sound very interesting. What should we look for in those tools?
Well, if you think about yourself on a journey, we're all on a journey, whether to be a successful business person, an athlete, a parent.
Yes.
The first step is to know your path. So that's emotional awareness. And, yes. And that's really the cornerstone to emotional mastery. And then you basically have to be focused to stay on that path, or you're going to get lost. That's emotional connectedness.
Yes.
And then we talked about emotional bravado, which is, you know, there's going to be a lot of fears along the way, and you got to deal with those fears. Then there's also emotional preparedness, which is really confidence. You have to be confident that you know you're taking that path, the correct path. And then there's emotional drive. It's going to take a lot of energy to make that journey. And then the last one is emotional balance, because if you're not balanced, you're going to burn out on the way on your journey. So it's all about being successful on your journey. But those components are all components of emotional toughness. You know, we talk about, a lot of people have heard emotional intelligence, EQ,
yes.
But I've devised it into six different components,
right.
And I call it emotional toughness.
Ah, interesting. Because when I hear the word emotional balance, I think of the, you know, some of the Eastern philosophies and the disciplines where they talk about the even mind, you know, not being either extreme, kind of a balanced style. So are you telling people to maintain equilibrium in terms of their personal life and work life? Are you talking about not letting yourself get too excited or too depressed? What would you call emotional balance in your system?
Well, there's a lot of different ways to look at it, but as a different way I talk about in the book is there's a balance between mastery goals and competitive goals. You know, a lot of us are always focused on mastery goals would be self-improvement.
Right.
A lot of people are focused on being the best.
Yes.
But the idea is that when you're always focused on being the best, you can burn out. And if you're only focused on mastery, there's not that fire inside to keep on getting better. So there needs to be a balance between the mastery goals and the competitive goals.
Yeah, because you work a lot with athletes. And I played tennis in high school. I did martial arts, weight training, and things like that. And my son actually played some college and semi-pro basketball. So I recognize the idea that mastery is basically wanting to be the improve yourself and get better versus performance. Or you, I think you said it. How did you describe it? The other kind of goals?
Competitive goals.
Okay. So in terms of like an athlete, I mean, once you get the endorsements and all the money, do you think they lose that mastery drive, or do they still maintain it to keep going in their excellence?
Well, if you look at Michael Jordan, and he said this many times, you know, what I did, and I'll quote him,
yes.
You know, and I'm speaking what Michael Jordan has said is that I had flaws, and what I did to stay motivated was to work on these flaws,
yes.
To keep on getting better. So people think Michael Jordan, and they consider him one of the greatest basketball players of all time, he always worked on self-improvement, and he always tried to win NBA championships. So there was a balance between both the mastery and competitive goals. And so he's a perfect example of this.
I see. In terms of athletes that you've met, professionals, I know some of them can be a little bit arrogant in a negative way. Some are more humble or good-hearted. Who's been the athlete that you've liked the most in your experience?
Well, I mean, if you look at one of the greatest comebacks that happened yesterday, Tiger Woods would be, you know, someone who's playing right now,
yes.
Who I think has become more humble in the past because of all the things that have happened to him.
Right.
And I would never say he was arrogant as much as super confident. See, I think there's a big difference between arrogance and confidence.
Yes.
People who are arrogant, they think they know it all, and so they don't listen to you.
Right.
Tiger's not like that. He listens to people. He's had coaches.
Okay.
But he's super confident, and he believes in himself, and that's why I think he's had this amazing comeback.
I see. How about, did you work with Tiger Woods?
No, I've never worked with Tiger. I've worked with some players on the PGA Tour, but never Tiger.
Okay. Yeah, because I think if you know them personally, it may make a difference in terms of the way you see them. But the other thing is the emotional toughness triad you talk about. And I think you say things like be aware, create primers, and something about being squeezed and getting, instead of orange juice, you get confidence. So what's that all about?
Well, I when I go speak, I usually have an orange in my hand, and I basically say, you know, If I squeeze this orange, what comes out? People
yes.
say juice. And I said, no, it could be pineapple juice, right? It has to be orange juice. And then
yes.
the question is why? Why does orange juice come out? And then the answer is because that is what is inside.
Yes.
And then the third question is, what have you put inside? Have you put in fear, negativity? Mm-hmm. That's what you get when you get squeezed, because we all get squeezed under pressure, whether it's business or sports or music or school. But the greatest, most successful people, they put in the right juice, the right, what I call primers. Yes. They put in compassion and confidence and peace of mind. And so related to the emotional toughness triad, you have to be aware of the times you are most successful, what we call maybe, you know, when you're in the flow or the zone,
right,
and you performed at your best. And then the idea is almost look at that and actually write it down and describe it. And you'll see words that are emotionally charged. And what I mean by that is then you could figure out primers. Primers are words, actions, and images which can mimic that flow state. So for instance, if someone is super intense and they have a high intensity level, maybe their primer for a word, or I call their power words, are find the fire. And so every time they say that and they kind of feel the supercharge when they say that, they fill themselves up with the right juice. And so then when they get squeezed at that right moment, the right juice comes out.
I like that. I can even think in relationships, you know, everything can be honeymoon stage when everything's going great, but when you have a conflict or challenge, this way you get to know the real person, and you know, their nature comes out. And I like to use the word a hot teapot can only pour hot tea, so whatever is already in there comes out. And you're talking about, I guess, love versus fear, and you do mention something called the negativity bias, which is, I think, is a psychological term where oftentimes the negative things kind of stand out more because they make more impact. You know, I guess evolutionary wise, people for survival need to be attuned to that. So how do we switch from negativity bias to a positivity bias to see things in a more positive way?
Well, the negativity bias comes from our ancestors when we were hunters and gatherers. Right. And that 40,000 years ago, we had to be fearful and negative. Yes. Like we had to do that for survival. We had to be fearful. If we go over that mountain, we might get killed. So we basically had to be prepared for that. The problem is a lot of people have taken that negativity bias and then have kept it. Mm-hmm. And so they're still negative about everything. And I think what happens is it becomes a habit. And so you just have to change that habit and be aware of that habit and flip it to become more positive. Because I think the chances are much greater if you have a positivity habit, you're going to be more successful and happier.
Yeah, but they even did some studies on luck. They said that lucky people often are more optimistic because they are more open to experiences. They look at the bright side of things. So they have a whole different perspective. And Greg, when you're talking about primers, that's a very interesting idea. Give me an example of a primer. Let's say that we're in a business situation and we're overwhelmed, we're pressured and all that, and we have to make a speech or something, a presentation, and we're scared. You know, we may screw up this thing. So what would be a little primer we can get put in our head to do well in this business presentation?
Well, I'll just give you an example for me. So when I was speaking about 10 years ago to a group, I was in the zone, and I had to ask myself why I was in the zone.
Yes.
And it was because I was just sharing my knowledge, and sharing is a joyous state. So my primers, my buzzwords are just share. So every time I go speak, I feel like I'm just sharing my knowledge.
Yes.
And that puts me at the right emotional state.
I see. We also mentioned some athletes were so-called dissed when they were younger. They got cut from a team, or I think you said Muhammad Ali, someone stole his bike, and then they use that as kind of almost a revenge motivation. You think that's healthy or unhealthy?
Well, it just depends if it works well. I mean, the idea is that if you can have – finding the right primers, it takes a lot of work. It's kind of like that song. You know, if you think about it, a song can make you super happy or can make you sad.
Right.
And the right words, actions, and images that push your emotions like the song – is the key. So if you could find that, then that's the secret.
I like that. So find your song, whatever that motivator is. And it could be, I guess, an actual song, or it could be an idea or a thought.
Exactly. It could be an image. But the idea is that when you have primers that are as powerful as a song, then you have the right primers.
Interesting. Now, Greg, you know, we have Love University, but you have a different kind of university. You call it Emotional Toughness University. Now, are we going to have to run a lot of laps in your university and run miles? What do we have to do?
Well, what I did with Full Throttle is I filmed a bunch of videos and then articles and applied exercises. So Emotional Toughness University is exactly what we talked about earlier. It's six sections. every section has videos, articles, and applied exercises that people could go through. And then the idea is that when they go through the Emotional Toughness University, not only do they get a certificate, but they get more emotionally tough and learn the knowledge base they need to be successful in any field that they're in.
Wow. So we can kind of have students go back and forth, right? They'll come to Love University for love and to you for emotional toughness. So
Exactly.
We can have exchange students, I guess.
That's right.
Now, one thing here, when we talk about mastering feelings or being emotionally tough, you know, I've done work with the Myers-Briggs personality type and written some books on love types and relationships in Myers-Briggs. And, you know, there is a type called the feeling personality style, male or female, that's more directed to very, very emotional and sensitive. And, you know, they make decisions based on their values. And if you tell a feeling person, you know, don't take it personally, they'll say, well, I take it personally because that's my nature. So what do you say to someone that's a very feeling person? And for them, that's part of their existence. So if you tell them, you know, don't be so much of a feeler, that will go against their grain. What do you do in that situation?
Well, going back to the cornerstone to emotional toughness, it's emotional awareness. So like you said, people have to be aware of what turns them on and what turns them off,
right?
What gets them in the zone and gets them in flow, what makes them happy, what makes them successful.
Yes.
Once they realize that, then they move in the right direction. So mm-hmm. like you said, if they realize that they have to be touchy-feely and that's what makes them happy and successful,
yes.
then that's what they want to emphasize.
I see. Are you a thinker or a feeler, Greg?
Thinker.
Okay. So isn't it easier for you guys to do? I mean, I'm a feeler myself as a male. Isn't it easier for you to just detach from emotions and just be logical and rational than it is for us feeler types?
No, I think that's my preference. I like to think through stuff and analyze it and then I guess be prepared for the emotions I need to share.
Right. But I'm saying, but if you're a feeling person, that's not your style. You're not going to analyze feelings. You're just going to feel it. You might suffer pain and anguish, but then you have the joys of the emotion on the other side. So what's the advice to the feeling people? You don't say feeling males or feeling females.
Well, again, I think it just comes from knowing yourself and what you like to do. And you know, there's some situations you got to share emotions, and that's what I try to do. But you have to know your preferences. And, of course, your partner has to know your preferences. And, you know, like you said, there's different personality types. Well, what goes on with those personality types? If you look at the brain, you know, I get more rewarded when I'm more in the thinking, and I get less rewarded right. when I'm sharing my emotions. So the idea right. is, why do I become more of a thinker? Because that's mm-hmm. the way I'm set up.
Uh-huh.
I get rewarded that way.
I see. So then basically feed your reward system, whatever it is that your style is, you know, do more of that.
No, it's just knowing like, well, that and if your partner knows that, well, he prefers thinking and less sharing his emotions, and if I'm forced to share my emotions and I might not want to do it, and that makes me uncomfortable, then if the partner is more aware of their partner, then that's going to help the relationship as well.
Definitely. Yeah, we talk about that love types, how to appreciate the differences and respect each other's style. Now, the other thing, Greg, is you have a very, very nice term here I like. You talk about the life song, and you say we need to be aware of that life song and create notes to it. And when you talk about life song, are you talking about your passion or mission in life, or you're talking about a peak emotional state like Mihaly's flow? What do you mean by emotional song?
Well, what I call life song, it could relate to a few things, but it really stemmed from the purpose. The idea is what makes you purposeful in life. That's your life song.
Yes.
And then people think purpose is, you know, an outcome. Like I have a purpose to get a degree in psychology, but purpose is also an emotion. You can be purpose filled.
Yes.
And if you think of it as an emotion, or what I say, purpose is a verb,
yes.
then you can make it every day, mm-hmm. an everyday action by using the right words, actions, and images to push your emotions to become more purpose filled.
Hmm. So what if your purpose is just to be a good family person, a good spouse, a good parent, and I have no real career ambitions? Is that okay?
Yeah, of course. I mean, everyone has different purposes.
Okay.
But again, you know, I think the idea is once they discover that what really, you know, we say passion and we say, you know, what drives us, but really what drives us and what's our passion is really what is our purpose. And so whatever drives you is the secret.
That makes sense, yeah. Of course, you know, in the religious or spiritual sense, there's a book called The Purpose-Driven Life that says, you know, there's a higher nature or God that the purpose comes from there. Where do you think purpose comes from? Is it from a higher source? Is it from a person's internal mechanism?
Well, I think it's related to religion and spirituality. You know, I think what religion gives us is a sense of purpose. So there's definitely, there's a different tie-in, but you could take it, if you take it out of the religious part and say, you know, what drives us the most is to be purpose-filled. You know, we call it meaning, purpose, right. But ultimately that's the higher, our higher sense of self. Once we discover that, which a lot of people do not, but once you discover that, then you're more fulfilled. And you have that, what we call the peace and joy and that contentment you seek. I tell my class where I teach at Austin Peay State University, I tell them, you know, what's your number one goal in college? And everyone says, oh, to get a degree, right. To get educated. Right. No, it's to find that calling in your life, you know, right. To be purpose-filled every day. Yes. And if you do that, your life gets much easier.
Yeah, and when I teach, I say, what is your true motivation deep inside? You want to help people. Maybe your dad didn't treat you a certain way. You want to show them that you can make it, or maybe you want to, you know, have your kids proud of you. You know, say you have children. So everyone has a different, I guess, drive or motivation. But the other thing you talk about, Greg, is very interesting. Is that you have a term called falling forward, which sounds to me like I guess learning from your mistakes or failures and getting them out of the way so you can have successes. Now you have an interesting story. You told me you went on 500 dates on Match.com before you found your wife. So that's like a one date a week for 10 years. And I'm wondering, you're a handsome guy. You look like Will Ferrell. How did it take you 10 years to find your wife?
Well, of course, you know, I did that on my TED Talk, and I was just having fun.
Oh, okay.
I said 432 dates. Not fun. Don't exaggerate. But the idea is, and I speak about this in my class, you know, everybody from Thomas Edison to Steve Jobs to whoever it is, we all fail. You know, if you look at the iceberg of success, everyone's failed 100 times more than they've succeeded. You just don't see those failures. You only see that one or two successes. But the secret is, how do you get overcome those failures? Mm-hmm. Well, one way is to understand that the failures are just stepping stones to success. As mm-hmm. Thomas Edison would say, that was once he discovered the wrong way to invent the light bulb, he said, that's a path I no longer needed to take. And so he failed forward, and he moved in a different direction.
Right. I think you said it took him like 10,000 tries or something to find the right filament for the light bulb. But, I mean, going back to you, I work a lot with singles. Why do you think it's so hard for single people who are attractive, intelligent, and really nice people to find their soulmate in our society, even though we have all these dating options and all that? Why do you think it's so difficult?
It's a hard answer because it could stem from history, you know, from, you know, parenting and all that. I would say if I could kind of throw away some of that, and the negative baggage, I would say there's probably two. The first one is they're not really aware of what they want. They have an ideal of what they want, and they search for that, and it never fulfills them. So becoming aware of what they truly want is the secret. And then be realistic. You know, they're searching for the perfect mate.
Right.
There's never going to be the perfect mate. Everyone's going to have flaws. Mm-hmm. And stop setting the bar so high, because you're never going to find that.
You seem like you have a very a beautiful wife and very nice. What is it that you love about her?
Well, you know, of course, right now we have a child. So, of course, she's a great mother.
Great.
She's considerate and thoughtful and definitely mature in the sense of the relationship.
Right.
And always makes me a better person, both husband and father.
That's a great answer. Of course, she's there listening to you right now, so I'm sure she liked that. Right. Now, Greg, one thing is that's very interesting, because you have a similar term that I use. I work a lot with trauma victims in psychology, helping them who've overcome a lot of issues. I call it pain into power. You call it tragedy into transcendence. And you even mentioned it in one of your stories that your wife had a miscarriage. It was a big tragedy for you guys. But you say that you can turn that into a sense of power or something different. How do people do that? You know, when they go through horrible circumstances in life, how do they become better from that?
Well, I have a book that I'm about to publish. It's called Fall Up.
Oh,
and what happened was I interviewed all these people who had a terrible tragedy, whether it was, you know, death of a spouse or a loved one or losing a limb. And what I discovered was that while they've always said that it was very painful at first, that they became better for it.
Yes.
That, you know, there was transcendence from the tragedy. And ultimately, they found their purpose. So that the tragedy helped them to find their life song, their purpose.
Yeah, I think you have a cool term. You call it transcend, and then you have a slash ability. So it's kind of like two words in one. So transcend, right, and then ability to transcend.
Right. Just, that's the skill set, we call it, that people who turn tragedy into transcendence have transcendability.
That's kind of cool. And then you even go further. You say, well, you've heard of Kubler-Ross's stages of grieving and all that, denial and things like that. But you say you have a stages of transcendence, which you've created, and you think like the wake-up call and other things you talk about. Tell us a little bit about the stages of transcendence.
Well, again, going back to transcendability, it was that the person had a terrible tragedy, and that was like a wake-up call. They realized they weren't on the path they needed to be.
Right.
So they changed their path, and so they got out of their comfort zone, and they realized strengths and talents they never knew existed. That was actually the third stage, and they used that to basically find their life song, which is the ultimate stage. And so when we talk about Kubler-Ross, you know, she has those stages, and they're famous, and they're anger, denial, depression, bargaining, and the last one's acceptance.
Right.
Well, I think there's another stage. The next stage is transcendence. So she's actually missing the last stage.
Hmm. Interesting. And then you break transcendence down into, I guess, five elements. You mentioned something like release your genius. And
that was find strengths and talents you never knew existed.
I see. And then create the life song. And the last one you had in this subcategory, you said from me to we. And I'm thinking, is this kind of an Eastern approach to collectivist consciousness? Or how do you define me to we?
Well, I think it could relate to that, but I was just basically saying, and people see this all the time. They lose a daughter to a tragedy, and a terrible tragedy, and it's very painful, and they start a charity. Mm-hmm. So it's from a me to a we. That's what I meant, is that they're trying to give back and create awareness and create a change in the world.
Yeah, I guess you could say a sense of compassion or even love. And, you know, Love University, we believe that love is the essential thread that goes through a lot of these things, you know, the loving energy toward yourself, others, or a higher nature. So I guess, I think you have a mention of a model who was lost her boyfriend to with the typhoon or something like that, or in Thailand. And then she started helping a lot of children from that as well. So
So she went through the stages and basically found her life song after a terrible tragedy.
Yeah, and then started looking at other people's pain, right, trying to alleviate others' pain.
Right, and then she started a charity called Happy Hearts Fund, where she opens schools throughout the world.
Yeah, that's awesome.
Yeah, that's a great story.
So that kind of stuff, you know, having compassion, you know, to relieve the suffering of others, or even empathy to put yourself in their shoes, this is something that's sometimes as common in, you know, individualistic societies where people, you know, it's all about you, right? It's all about your goals and your things. How do we get people to be more compassionate? Is there a way to do that, more empathetic?
Well, like you mentioned earlier, Maslow's hierarchy of needs, you have the basic needs, and then the need to shelter, and then the need for ego, and then the need really for, I know the last one he actually added was transcendence, but it's really, once you fulfill your needs and you become more mature, then I think that's when you can become more compassionate. The problem is when you're always on the climb for more materials, wealth, power, it's hard to you know, become transcendent because you're always in that ego need.
Right.
So it's really kind of a maturity thing.
I would think with athletes, and, you know, especially if they're high earning and very successful or famous, the spiritual side is something that would be very helpful to develop. But is it hard to get them to develop the spiritual side of things when they have so much money and power?
Well, some of the athletes that are more spiritual, I think it gives them a peace and a sense of calmness under pressure because there's a higher power. And I'm not saying they don't all do that, but I think the ones that are very spiritual and religious, it gives them that sense of peace.
Yeah, that makes sense. Now, I see here in your material, you use a word a few times that's called superpowers. So I'm wondering, are you a fan of the Marvel comics? Do you love superpowers?
I just put that in there because it's catchy, you know.
Okay.
I mean, it's ultimately what I was saying is purpose.
Purpose, yeah.
Is a superpower, you know, like you would say love is a superpower.
Yes.
Compassion is a superpower.
Right. Exactly. Well, you know, in the martial arts, there's a point called the hara, which is 2 inches below your navel. It's kind of your center of your gut or instinct. I don't know if you've heard about that, where martial artists can break boards and all that when they focus on this point. And the idea of having your purpose statement, I think you talk about finding out who you admire why you admire them, and what you can do to, I guess, contribute to the world. Is that kind of the idea, to develop a purpose?
Well, those are just kind of, I guess, clues to help you.
Yes.
Because a lot of people have never discovered their purpose, and it's difficult for a lot of people. And I think one of the secrets is to look at what other people have done and what you admire. And by knowing that, that helps you to find your purpose.
That makes a lot of sense. And then, Greg, the other thing is that, you know, you talk about pressure, and especially athletics, but also, I guess, in business presentations or business life, there's a lot of pressure. And you say, first of all, you have to look at it in a different way. You talk about it to see it as an honor. So let's say if you're in the NBA finals, you know, obviously you got there, so it's a big honor. Or if you're in a big presentation, it's a good thing. So why is that important to see it as an honor?
Well, it's how you label your emotions. So I call it turn pressure into pleasure, you know.
Oh,
and
okay.
So every situation you can see it differently depending on how you label it, and that changes your emotions. So if you're up there giving a presentation to 1,000 people, yes, it's pressure packed, but it's an honor to be there. And I got it from Billie Jean King, because she would say, the famous tennis player, she would say, look, I'm in the finals, but it's a privilege to be here.
Right.
And it would change her emotions.
Makes a lot of sense. Now, we're out of time for today, but I really want to thank you, Dr. Steinberg, for being here today. And if you want to hear more about Dr. Steinberg, you can go to his website at drgregsteinberg.com. That's drgregsteinberg. And for Love University, if you'd like to hear more about us and be a guest on our show, or maybe send us questions, you can write to us at lovetype4u@aol.com. That's LOVETYPE, the number 4, letter U at AOL.com. Go to our website at loveuniversity.love. Call us at 310-226-8090. You can also like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter and Instagram. Until next time, this is Dr. Alex Avila with Love University. Put away your notepads, iPads, computers and phones. Class is now dismissed.